And by the time that we get to a place where we have kids locked up in cages, it feels so big and overwhelming that people don't know what to do to stop it, right? And it's like, well, you could have just believed people's truth when they tried to tell you this was coming.
Today's episode is sponsored by Etched Communication, a full-service public relations and crisis management firm. Connect with Etched via its website at etchedcom.com. etchedcomm.com.
On March 1st, 2019, today's guest wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post. This is her closing paragraph. What I do know is that when I returned to Tucson, I was welcomed and embraced. I put on my collar and served communion to all those who sought it. I began the work of comforting students and others in my ministry at the University of Arizona. Many of them are already acquainted with struggle. They're undocumented or putting themselves through school or enduring the effects of racism and discrimination against Black and Indigenous people in this country. And they know how to be brave. We will move forward. We will grieve. But we will not let the events of this past week shake us and shake our inner resolve to continue God's work. This chapter of begging people to love us is over. Now we will lean into God, the one we know loves us unconditionally. Those words were written by the Reverend Hannah Adair Bonner, who is our guest today on Our Voices Matter, and I'm so honored to meet you.
So much.
Thank you for taking the time to share who you are and what you do and why you do it with our audience. And I want to start by asking you to put what I just read into context for our audience. Why did you write that?
So in this past spring, the United Methodist Church met in St. Louis to have a discussion, a legislative gathering, about the future of queer clergy like myself within the United Methodist Church. And there was, of course, a debate that has been going on for decades about this. And what ended up happening was that what was called the traditional plan passed. The traditional plan raises the consequences for those who would openly say that they accept and love who they are, as I do. As a member of the LGBTQ community, I accept and I love who I am, and I feel that God made me this way and that God celebrates and takes joy in the ministry that I do. And so to penalize us and also to penalize those who would officiate at same-sex weddings is the result. Those penalties were already in place, but in a lot of parts of the country, as on the West Coast and parts of the Northeast, they were moving forward in the call of the Spirit and treating these as ways that they needed to serve their community despite what the law books may say, because Martin Luther King taught us, if a law is unjust, we have a responsibility to break it. And so there are folks that have been continuing forward and will continue forward to serve. And so as we continue into this coming year and the spring of 2020, we will again have this conversation and we will find out the future of this denomination.
So what has been the fallout, if there was any, from the op-ed that you wrote in the Washington Post and just from your stance in general in the church?
I'm somebody who's fairly accustomed to controversy. I'm willing to say the hard thing that needs to be said for the protection of the most vulnerable. And so as a result, there have been many times that I've found myself in the line of fire during my career. As a young woman who is ordained, I have always received resistance, right? That it's a new era for the church. And so I'm accustomed to that. The controversy, therefore, that my op-ed raised was less so about what I'd written, because people are used to me saying controversial things, and I didn't receive opposition because folks are accustomed to that from me. But what I received opposition about was my use of the word queer. Because I think that for folks in the older generations who are LGBTQ, that's a word that's hurtful because it was used against them. And so I've learned to try to balance the way that I use language.
I'm actually glad that you brought that up, because I wanted to ask you if you could explain to our audience how the LGBTQ community has taken that word back.
Right.
And tried to own it in a way that makes it something that you can be proud to say, as opposed to the reverse.
Right. So, and I'm not sure I'm the expert on that, but what I can say is that to use the word queer is, it's a political act, right? It's an act of claiming the intersectionality of injustice. It's a way of bringing together the many different ways that we are manifested as beautiful creations of God in this world, and to have one word that kind of brings us together, that we can act politically united from, that doesn't carry the baggage of it carries a baggage for those for whom that word has been used to hurt, but for others, there are other words that carry baggage because of the ways that the movement has sometimes been focused on white folks, the ways that it has left out trans folks at times, right? And so it's a word that feels like it brings people together.
It's more inclusive.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But I understand for other folks how it can be wounding, and so I'm trying to find that
balance. There's a balance there, yeah. I want to go a little bit into your backstory, if you wouldn't mind. Tell me a little bit about how you grew up. When did you know that you wanted to be a minister? And when did you know you were gay?
Okay. I would say that my calling first began in the pews of Thornbury African Methodist Episcopal Church, which is up the street from my house near the campus of Cheney University, which is the oldest HBCU in the country, and outside of Philadelphia. And it was in the pews with Miss Beulah Derry, and looking up at her and seeing the way that she loved God and she loved others and she loved me, and wanting to be a part of that work in the world. That work of healing and that work of bringing light and beauty to the world. I think that because I was a young woman who I would visit at Thornbury, Amy. But
I was just going to say, so you're obviously white, yeah. Okay? So how did you end up spending so much time in a black church?
Well, it was up the street from my house.
Okay, so it was close.
And, yeah, and so you know we'd be invited. Our family would be invited to start there sometimes.
Okay.
And
right.
So my grandmother was she was an immigrant from Ireland. And when she was still living, she liked to spend time with the women at the AME church doing crafts and different volunteering things and stuff like that. And so they loved her. And I never really got to know her that well because she died when I was young. And in a way, they passed that love to me by loving me.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah, and so that's kind of how I had that relationship. But I was a member of a United Methodist Church that was very opposed to the United Methodist Church accepts and celebrates women in leadership, but my congregation was kind of in resistance to that. So they were against women in leadership. They were against pretty much everything that I am. And so I had a calling, but because I was in a space that told me I couldn't be a leader as a woman, it was a difficult path to be willing to say that, to say I have a call, and to overcome the shame that had been put on me simply as a woman, not even as a member of the LGBTQ community, but as a woman, right? Mm. And so it wasn't until I was, you know, in college that I was willing to say I wanted to go to seminary, and then once I was graduated from seminary before I was willing to say I wanted to be a pastor. And so I had to work through that false shame. I always knew I was called. But I had been told it was wrong for me to do as a woman. And so to now be told that it's wrong for me to do as an LGBTQ person, I've been being told this my whole life as a woman, and I know that that was wrong, and I know that this is wrong as well, that God called me in the wholeness of who I am. In terms of, you asked, when did I know that I was queer, and that would be, I guess, you know, there's parts of myself that always wondered, but also because of the environment that I was in, I didn't want to admit it to myself or to others. I would say that when I was here in Houston, it was something that I felt was very likely. However, my work was so focused on uplifting the voices of others, and it was high-risk work that I was doing and confronting white supremacy. And I felt, at that time that it was not something that I could take on facing. And I also felt that myself and those that were working with me were already under so much attack because of the work we were doing to confront white supremacy that I did not need to bring one more thing into this for us to be attacked about.
So talk to me about that work, confronting white supremacy. What did that look like?
It looked like a lot of different things, right? It looked like supporting, you know, immigrant families at the bus station. But most directly, I think the thing that people most would associate me with is the fact that when Sandra Bland died in the Waller County Jail, we had mutual friends. And those mutual friends required a response from me as their pastor. And that I ended up there feeling called by God to be there and ended up continuing to follow that call and to stay, to continue to be there at the Waller County Jail for the first 3 months after her death and continue to do the work very directly in rural Texas for the next couple years and then to continue to be involved in relationships with folks there and to continue.
And so just for the purposes of our audience who might not know who Sandra Bland was, she was a young African-American woman who was stopped by a police officer in Waller County, taken out of her car, taken to jail. It was a very controversial case. And then 3 days later, she was found hanged in her jail cell. And as we're doing this interview today, which is July 14th, yesterday was the anniversary of her death.
Yes.
And you were very involved in commemorating that.
Yes.
Tell me why that is still so very important to you.
Yeah.
All these years later.
For me, Sandra was somebody who in January of 2015, 6 months before her death, she received a call from God one night. And she had her makeup washed off and her hair in curlers and she was ready for bed. But she put a camera in front of her face and she started vlogging. And she said that we need to stop waiting for somebody to come along and to change the world. That God has opened my eyes, she said. She said, I'm going to talk about God. She said, I know that some people don't like people talking about God, but I'm going to talk about God because it's God that's opened up my eyes to the fact that there's something we can do. And she started a series of videos that went on for the next 6 months, where she was living out this calling. And as a pastor, after her death, when I saw that first video and I heard her say the words, it's time, y'all, it pierced me. It convicted me that the boldness with which she was doing the work, the boldness with which she was combining unapologetically her fight for justice and her calling to proclaim her faith. And as a pastor, I felt convicted that she was doing it better than I was in terms of being so unapologetic both about her calling, because I think that as people, sometimes in certain circles, as she was acknowledging in her video, people don't want to hear about God, right? And so she was like, I'm going to talk about God. And I felt convicted that there were some times where I didn't talk about God in certain spaces that I should because I knew it made people uncomfortable, even as a pastor. I felt so convicted by her calling and so convicted by her boldness. And so I moved forward in a way that was determined not to allow them to succeed in silencing the call that God had put on her and to make sure. So for much of the world, the focus was about her death, right? For me, it was about her voice and her life, and making sure that people listened to her words and that she was able to live out this calling that she'd been given, even beyond her life, that people would still be hearing this and that the obedience that she had to the call of God to speak these words of love and truth and justice and healing to the world would continue to be heard.
You mentioned that for 3 months following her death that you lived outside of the Waller County Jail. Why? And what was that experience like for you?
So about a few days into it, one of the older grandmotherly figures from Houston told her daughter, y'all better not be sleeping out there. And so we were respectful of our elders, and we didn't actually sleep out there. But yes, we were out there every day until, you know, from morning to dark. The reason why we were there and what we experienced, I mean, initially for the first 5 days that I was there because I felt that somebody needed to be with her. that this woman had been falsely, illegally arrested. The officer was later arrested for arresting her, for lying about arresting her, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like there's no doubt about the fact that it was wrong she was in custody, right? That's not up for debate. So she was wrongfully in this space. We don't know how she lost her life. Looking at the facts, the fact that there's no DNA and there's no fingerprints on the trash bag with which it was supposedly, it's just like, it makes more sense that this didn't happen the way they said it did than that it would. It's while we cannot be sure what happened, I feel 100% certainty that what they said happened is not what happened, right? And so she was there. She was in their custody, right? And until her family could come and get her and take her from them, she was still in the hands of the people who'd done this to her, right? And so in somewhat of the tradition that many religions have of sitting, you know, in the Jewish tradition, I think it's sitting Shiva, right? Mm-hmm. So of sitting with her, I felt I just wanted to be with her, like, so that she wasn't alone. And so for the first 5 days, that's why I was there. But when the family came to receive her body and to take her home and to honor her and bury her, I ended up looking in their eyes and the words just came out of my mouth, "I'll do this as long as you need me to." And those were not planned words. But that was a commitment, and and it was a calling, and it was something that I needed to follow through on, and I did. And remained in relationship and communication with the family, and continued to be outside of the jail to ask what happened to Sandra Bland, because by asking the question, what happened to Sandra Bland, we were confronting the reality that what they said happened is not what happened, that we don't know what happened, but that what they said happened is not what happened. And so by holding that sign outside of the jail for those months, and at first the sheriff didn't take us very seriously. I think he thought I was just some little girl. And I love being underestimated. It gives me a chance to prove people wrong. And so he underestimated us. He threatened us. He got in our face. I think by August, he came out and took pictures of our cars and our faces. And he told me to go back to the Church of Satan, which is that many people saw that moment because we were able to capture him on film and share that. And so they tried to threaten and intimidate us and get us to leave. And the reality is that they tried to make us think, and people believed, even within the Methodist Church, people believed with certainty that I would die. Like, it was not a question, if.
So you received serious death threats, mm-hmm, while you were there.
Right. And so the thing was, people really believed, you have to stop. If you keep doing this, you will die. Not maybe, you will. And the reality for me was that it was a calling from God, and I'm more afraid of God than I am of any human being, right? I was not about to disobey God for another human being. And secondarily, it was important to show people that the value, the worth of my life, and the value and worth of Sandra's life were equal. Right? And if you're going to be so upset about the danger that I'm supposedly in,
I, as a white woman,
right?
Okay, yeah.
Then where is your outrage about the danger that she was in? Mm. Right? And so that's why it was important to do that, and it was also why it was important to keep the focus on her. To do that fine balance of confronting people with that uncomfortable reality while at the same time being very strategic about keeping myself from becoming centered in the national narrative.
Yeah, I want to talk about that. We were talking off camera before we started about how you've been approached by the national media to do interviews, and what was your response in each case?
I would give them the name of a black woman who was a leader in Houston to talk to, or in Waller County where it took place.
And you did that because?
Because it was our conviction to keep this focused on the folks that are directly impacted by systemic racism. And I actually refused to talk to even local media for the first couple weeks, maybe even, I don't remember how long, it was at least a couple weeks that I refused to speak to local media even until I was receiving word from the family that was not helpful to the case, that it would be good for me to.
But you were sensitive to the fact that you did not want the face of a white woman to be the reason that this was getting so much attention.
That would defeat the purpose, right?
Exactly, mm-hmm. Exactly. You also are doing a lot of work in the immigrant community now. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about that.
All right, so I'm in Tucson, Arizona, and in Arizona, and California has San Diego and Tijuana, and Texas has El Paso and Juarez, but Arizona doesn't have the big city on the border, and so Tucson does take that responsibility of being that border city that is focused on what can we do, right? And so I spend a lot of my time these days at The Inn, which is a Methodist ministry which houses asylum seekers as they're released from custody and helps them to prepare to travel to family and offers them love and support in that moment. And so that is really healing and beautiful work. And I am able to, I think that for me it's important to honor the strength and the incredible courage of these folks who have survived so much to make it to where they are. And so that's a big part of my life. And for those of us who live in Tucson and on the border, the kind of things that we're seeing now in the national media, that's just life always, yeah. Right? Sometimes it gets big enough and bad enough that the rest of the nation starts to pay attention. But it's always there. The abuses are always there. And so we're always resisting in some way.
When I was actually in the car on the way here today to do the interview, I was listening to a radio show, and a gentleman who called in, happens to be African-American, was talking about the immigration crisis in the country, and was basically saying that you can't really compare what's happening at the border in terms of calling it, you know, concentration camps, et cetera, to slavery. Slaves were brought here. He's saying the people who are in these detention centers now came of their own free will. They weren't brought here. So it was a choice. And that because they made that choice, they should have to suffer the consequences of what happens when they get here. Okay, that was his argument, and this is an African-American man saying this. Obviously entitled to his opinion. It was a really interesting comment to hear, and I thought, okay. And then he went into this sort of diatribe about how we as Americans have to be very careful because in a few years, you know, all the Spanish-speaking people will have taken over the country and you won't be able to get a job if you can't speak Spanish. And it just kind of went on from there. And I thought, wow, okay, that's an opinion that I had not heard expressed, particularly by someone of color. Not that it matters. It was just interesting because he happens to be someone of color. But just that whole debate about there's not enough for us and them.
Right.
There's not enough. And we're afraid that if they come, they're going to take what's mine, what's ours. And there seems to be among the population of folks who believe this that that these people are not deserving of compassion or empathy or any of that.
Right.
So I would love your perspective as someone who is literally in the trenches in this. Not only as a human being, but also as a member of the clergy.
Right. There's so many layers to that.
Yeah.
I think I would start by saying that I sleep every Monday night at the shelter. I not only work and talk and love on folks, I fall asleep and I close my eyes with them. And they close their eyes with me, right? Like, we have trust that these are folks that are worthy of respect, that they are worthy of sharing space together like family in that way, right? So that's where I would start. I would say that we have, white supremacy is creative. I was talking with one of my students last night who had been receiving the message as a black woman that she should do everything on her own, that she shouldn't ask for help. And I was we were talking about the fact that that's one of the lies of white supremacy, that white people pulled ourselves up by our bootstraps and everyone else should have to do it. And it's that we didn't ask for help. That's correct. We didn't ask for help. We just took it. We just stole it, right?
Mm-hmm.
We took the labor of others. And so then we're perpetrating this lie that we pulled ourselves up, right, as a culture, and that others should have to do the same. And in the same way, so that is one lie of white supremacy. Another lie is that to keep people looking at those that will take the little thing that they have from them, and keep us fighting with one another, rather than understanding that the problem and the reason why we're struggling is those that have created a system of injustice. It's not those who are also experiencing injustice, right? And so white supremacy keeps all the communities that it tries to label as under, and it tries to marginalize, it only can survive and thrive by keeping people fighting with one another. And so I think that's one. As a pastor, wow.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's
yeah.
As a
yeah.
pastor, it doesn't, I can tell you that immigrants make our communities better, which is true. I can tell you that, you know, that I'm the granddaughter of an immigrant, and that people said terrible things about Irish immigrants at that as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that things just change, because part of how white supremacy stays on top is by bringing people in. And so when Irish immigrants came, they didn't include us, but now they do, right? Now my embodiment, if I allow it to, will uphold white supremacy if I don't resist and fight against that, right? Despite whatever my background was. And so I can say all that, but as a pastor, right? These are sacred children of God. The borders that are in our earth were carved there with violence by man. It is a fallacy to say that it is a sin for somebody to cross a line that we sinned by creating, that we took land from indigenous folks, and particularly like in the state of Texas, of course. We remember that we can talk about the difficult history and the way that Texas was not accepted initially by the rest of the nation and the way that it struggled. But we can also talk about the fact that slavery was abolished in Mexico, and that that's part of why Texas became independent, right? And that we have a complicated history, and that this was indigenous land, and that a lot of the folks that I encounter at the border are indigenous people. They are indigenous to Guatemala, indigenous to Honduras, and they are moving in the way that people on this continent have always moved, except now we have come and we have said, we drew these lines with our swords, we dug them in the dirt, and we said, you can't cross here anymore. These are things that are not of God. And so to call it a sin, to say that they are in the wrong, we can say that you've disobeyed our man-made laws. You can say that we feel threatened by you. You can say that we don't want to risk living with compassion because we are afraid that we won't have enough if we give some of what we have to you. We can say all those things, but we can't say that laws that we've invented, that ways that we have taken from others, that what we have taken from the indigenous people of these lands. So in Arizona, where I am, that's the Hona Autumn land, right?
Okay.
So the land, there is a line that goes through the Hona Autumn nation. Part of it's in the U.S. and part of it is in Mexico. Their community of indigenous folks is split by our border. They have
our man-made border.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
They have to cross our border to go for family members to visit each other within their own land, right? Mm-hmm. And so we, how can we then say that for somebody to come and to cross that line, that we took this from them, and now we're saying other people can't take from us what we took from them? We were here first. We called front seats on this car.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
And so we can say that. We can say that we have the money and we have the weapons to back up what we say. But I don't think that we have the moral high ground to say that we're right. And I think that the families that I interact with on a daily basis are people of such courage who have suffered so much. And it is so wounding to hear the national media, to hear the administration be like, say, these are gang members. These are, I'm having sopa de pollo with them right now. I'm hearing about what they went through in their home community. I'm hearing about the gangs in their home community that they're fleeing from. I'm hearing about the mothers that are seeking safety for their children. I'm living in community with folks, and that the administration is lying about, and that the media is some forms of media are allowing that lie to stand, right? And others are confronting it, right? So, thank you, and support the media, right? Because a healthy and vibrant and honest media is essential to our democracy, and we have to protect honest journalism. That's just a side note.
I appreciate you saying that. I really do. We have conversations about that a lot on this show. And it's one of the reasons that I'm doing the show. I mean, I am a journalist by profession. I have a master's degree in it. I practiced on the air in traditional broadcast journalism for almost 20 years. And now, you know, this is my medium and my way of contributing what I think is an important dialogue and bringing these kinds of stories and conversations to life, and ultimately with the goal of helping us just remember that, you know, we are all human.
Yes.
All of us, across borders and, you know, within borders.
Right.
We are all human, and we all have feelings, and we need to find a way to have empathy for each other, even those with whom we disagree, those that we don't like, those who have done us wrong, or whatever. We've got to find a way back to our humanity.
Right.
And as someone in the clergy, and with you're clearly brilliant and, you know, so well educated, and have decided to use your voice in a way that matters for so many people, not only of your community, but of all communities. As we are navigating this very contentious and difficult time, what are the key messages that you think are missing from this dialogue that will help us get back to a more humane society?
Right. I think that just in a very short amount of time, it feels as though we have lost all connection to the truth. And if a lie becomes something we disagree with, right? Like, I disagree with that, therefore it's a lie, right? I like what I'm hearing from this person, therefore it's the truth. And I don't feel like it used to be that way. I think that I'm going to sound old now, young people today.
Do you mind my asking, how old are you?
I'm 36.
36.
Older than people usually
get. Yeah. Okay.
But people who are teenagers today, who grew up on social media, who grew up like with media being created through YouTube and different things like that, in my generation first got our news from Jon Stewart, right? And so that is... they may not be able to remember what I remember as a kid, when what was presented, what was discussed, had a little. There was more integrity and more agreement about what, if you see something right in front of you, mm-hmm. that is being presented to you, perhaps on the news or in some other way, that you can believe your eyes. We don't believe our eyes anymore. Mm-hmm. We, you know, you can see You can see kids in cages. You can see all this stuff that's happening down on the border. But then, you know, the president says they're all dangerous, huge gang members. And people are like, okay, I believe that instead, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think that one thing is, like, we cannot have healthy, honest, loving, healing dialogue if people refuse to acknowledge the truth matters, that what we can see with our own eyes matters. And I remember back when I was sitting in front of the jail and when I was doing the work with Sandra Bland, and I would tell people what I was seeing, and they would tell me what they'd heard on the from somebody else or from the news, and I'd be like, I'm here.
Yeah. Like, I'm here. I'm seeing right? this. I'm sharing this with you right now.
Yeah, and likewise, when mm-hmm. I was at Tornillo, where they had kids in tents last summer, you know, and people would be saying what they'd heard, and I'm like, well, I'm literally standing here right now looking at it, and I see the kids. They are here, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think that we have to, like, we are sliding into this scary space where how can we have conversations if we can't, how dehumanizing is it to one another to deny what another person sees? And maybe that's part of our problem, because one of the big messages that I usually have when I'm speaking with white audiences who ask me to talk about, how to be a better accomplice or ally, right? The first thing I always say is simply believe black truth. Like, that part of our issue as white folks has been that we feel that we need to understand, experience, and approve of the truth of others.
Approve. Oh, wow.
Right?
So true. Yeah.
And so we have to let go of that if we're going to move forward, because part of how we've gotten to where we have gotten is that for so long we have insisted on, you have to convince me and I have to approve of what you're saying. And so you can tell me you're experiencing racism in the workplace, but I'm not experiencing racism in the workplace.
Therefore, it doesn't exist.
Therefore mm-hmm. you're not experiencing
therefore
racism
your
in the workplace.
Your reality is not valid.
Right. And so that's dehumanizing. That is a breaking of relationship, and it is demeaning to the other person. And so because for so long we have not just simply believed black truth, what we have said to, and I would broaden that to the truth of people of color, right, including so many different communities, mm-hmm, right? And especially mm-hmm. where mm-hmm. I am, indigenous and Latinx communities, right? Mm-hmm. If we simply believed it, we could move forward to, okay, this is the reality, this is what's happening, this is the right thing to do, let us do it. But because we won't believe what we're being told, we spend decades needing to be convinced. And by the time that we get to a place where we have kids locked up in cages, it feels so big and overwhelming that people don't know what to do to stop it, right? And it's like, well, you could have just believed people's truth when they tried to tell you this was coming, when they try to tell you. And so I think that that's one thing, is that we can start by believing one another and prioritizing experience, right? So I have interesting conversations with my college students. And
I'll bet.
I had a student that I was talking with last year who she felt that she felt upset that I was prioritizing the stories and the experiences and the opinions of immigrants about immigration over her own. And so she said, both are truth, both are real. My opinions about immigration, about how the system works, about what is true and not true about it, about what is true and not true of immigrants, is as valid as the immigrants' experience and opinions themselves. So I asked her, do you know any immigrants? No. Have you observed the system in any way? No. You know, like, so it's not just about, I think that people want to put the, like, opinions as equal, and it's not two opinions, it's experience and it's opinion.
Lived experience.
Right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So your opinion mm-hmm. formed without any information or experience mm-hmm. is not equal mm-hmm. to somebody who's lived it. Your opinion about what it's like to cross the border, why people do it, why people come here, your opinion about that, devoid of any actual facts or information or experience, is not equal to the person who has lived it. And you may choose to disagree with that person if you so choose, once you've really tried to listen, once you've really respected and at least believed that what they're telling you about their experience is true and real. You can say, I don't care. Mm-hmm. But we're not even taking the step to listen as if it's true, as if it matters.
Yeah. Wow. I could sit and talk to you for hours, and you've given us so much insight and so much to think about. As we wrap up, I want to ask, what's next for you? Mm-hmm. What are you taking on next? How are you going to take this fight and this passion that you have within you to move forward?
Yeah, I mean, we carry each thing and we build on it, right? And so I think that I still want to maintain a commitment to the calling that God's placed on my life and that other people have nurtured, which is, yes, to proclaim the gospel and also to understand that white supremacy is a heresy against that gospel because it seeks to prioritize some of God's children over others. And so I think that I do want to continue in that calling. And I think that I also am coming into a place where I don't have much choice about the matter at hand, which is the reality of what is happening within my denomination of the United Methodist Church and what will happen and whether my denomination will continue to be a place within which I can serve. I am elected, interestingly, to be a delegate in jurisdiction, in the Northeast jurisdiction where I'm from, as we have those conversations, and so I'll be deeply, deeply invested and involved in that, and I'm very grateful for the opportunity to speak for myself and not have others speak for me in that conversation. So that's where we're headed. So continuing in all these different ways, because it's all connected, right?
Yeah.
I think people think like, oh, Hannah's not doing this anymore, now she's doing this. No, it's all connected.
It's all part of the same. Yeah.
This is the face. This is the face that injustice is showing me right now. This is the facet of white supremacy that's in front of me right now. This is what I'll do in response as a person who seeks to be consistent to the call of God.
You're amazing. Thank you. Thank you so much for being who you are and speaking your truth and not being afraid to stand in it. And I know it comes at great peril, to be quite honest, as you've shared with us. So I wish you Godspeed.
I wish you
safety and security and good health and everything that makes you, Hannah, happy in your personal life. And please come back and talk with our audience again and update us on what's happening with you as you go forward. So
thank you. And if you don't mind me saying thank you for the work that you're doing. And I really do think that the work of truth, the work of community, the work of communication, the work of holding folks accountable to the fact that we should be in honest and loving dialogue with one another is what will save us. So thank you for doing this work.
My pleasure. Thanks so much, Hannah Adair Bonner. And thank you for watching. Thanks for giving Hannah permission to speak and for having the courage to listen with an open mind. We'll see you next time.
I'm a firm believer that if we can find a way to better understand each other's experiences, we can find a way to accept and respect each other for who we are, even when we don't agree. That's the ultimate goal of this podcast. So with that in mind, what do you want the world to know about your story? How might your story, your truth, provide an important perspective to help bridge our divides? If you'd like to share your story with us for a chance to be featured on the podcast, all you have to do is go to our website, ourvoicesmatterpodcast.com, and click on What's Your Story? We can't wait to hear from you because your voice matters.